Hey, 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 this is First Coast Connect. I'm Al Letson, sitting in the big chair, coming to you live from Studio 2 at WJCT. We have got a good show for you, but before we get started, good morning, everybody. It is hump day. Take a deep breath. All right, we got this. Today, how flawed algorithms are negatively impacting tenants in the housing market. And everything you need to know about the new COVID-19 boosters, plus how you can support WJCT. And you should totally support WJCT. I mean, I would love for you to support WJCT. But first, before we dive into that, landlords across the nation are implementing technology to screen prospective tenants. However, many argue background checking software is glitchy and aiding in discriminatory housing practices. Charlie McGee, an investigative reporter with The Tributary, is here with more details and how this issue is impacting renters in Jacksonville. Charlie, how you doing?
Doing all right. How are you?
Good, good, good. Okay, before we dive in, I should say that I am a proud member of the board of The Tributary. And if you, dear listener, want to join this conversation, we would really love you to. So call us at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Tweet us at First Coast Connect or FCC on air. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org or message us on the First Coast Connect Facebook page. We're also on Instagram. So, Charlie, let's talk a little bit about the story that you broke in The Tributary. Just to kind of set a baseline, right? So landlords across the country are using big tech and software to figure out if a prospective tenant is a good bet. Is that a safe way to describe it?
That is a safe way to describe it. This has kind of become an industry that's booming in its own right in the last maybe 20 years or so, as the rise of, you know, big data, and now we hear all about artificial intelligence everywhere, right? But really, I think the internet and just sort of the mass availability of data on people from courthouses, from, you know, any variety of sources has allowed this industry to boom, in which a company will basically be created for the sole purpose of going to as many landlords as they can, you know, across the country or anywhere, and saying, hey, we'll handle the screening process. You don't have to, you know, worry about that. You'll save money. It's cheaper to go to let us, you know, vet your rental housing applicants for you. And we're going to do it much quicker because we have this special algorithm that it's our proprietary technology. It's super accurate. It's, you know, tech, you know, it's just cutting edge type, you know, that pitch, right? And it's a fair argument. You know, landlords do need to vet rental applicants to some degree, but what has proven to be the case in, you know, for years and years up to the current date is that oftentimes these algorithms have flaws. And so this software that sort of automatically combs through thousands of court records to vet, you know, you, Al Letson, are applying for a rental apartment. Well, let's see if you've faced an eviction filing before. Let's see if you've faced, you have a criminal history, anything like that. And in this specific case, what I've dove into and what we sort of discussed in depth in this story in The Tributary is the fact that oftentimes these algorithms will mismatch someone. Let's say your name is John Smith, mm-hmm. and your birthday is December 14th. Well, they might use those three pieces of information and go happen to find a different John Smith who's born on December 14th of whatever the same year, right? And maybe you two have different middle names, but because the algorithm doesn't have a step to vet out that middle name, you just get matched up with a different person who had an eviction filing.
Let me ask you, is this, and you know, for the purposes of this conversation, I think it's important that I disclose that I am a landlord, mm-hmm. That I have a small apartment that I rent out to a wonderful tenant. Is this software, is it primarily for big landlords, or do they also do, like, you know, the little mom and pop, like someone like me?
Yeah, well, so this is something, you know, I talked to a bunch of lawyers who've litigated cases, you know, on this issue. And as they describe it to me, you know, around 20 years ago, it would only be the big institutional landlords who could get this kind of high tech, mm-hmm. Fast screening service because it was so much more expensive. However, as again, big data has become more available on everything, these reports are much cheaper to produce now. So much more information that is available. And so more and more, I think we're seeing mom and pop style shops, or maybe at least, you know, smaller scale landlords, maybe that have one property with, you know, one apartment complex, you know, midsize, who can all get this because it's, you know, a fraction of the cost. So it's, you know, the percentage I got was maybe 20 years ago, it was about 10% of landlords who got used these algorithms. Now it's something like 90%.
Wow. And I'm wondering, if, as a reporter, would you categorize Jacksonville as having a housing crisis?
I think that's manifestly clear in the data that there's a housing crisis in Jacksonville. And so it's going on across the United States, but the data indicates it's a little more intense in Jacksonville than most similar metro areas.
Right. So the reason why I ask that is because if we've got a housing crisis, landlords are looking for tenants. Tenants are clearly looking for places to stay. And then they're using this software that the tenant or the you know, presumptive tenant doesn't even really know anything about this software. They just know they're filling out an application. That application then goes into the software. The algorithms match you up with, you know, they're trying to look for you specifically, but they can by mistake match you up with somebody else. And then a bad report can come back based off of that.
That's true. And there's also an additional element of, you know, according to this lawsuit that was the sort of impetus of the story here in Jacksonville, but also other lawsuits, that maybe the algorithm does match you correctly. But let's say maybe 4 years ago, you had a landlord who filed a frivolous eviction filing against you. Like, he had no basis, but he was just, he had a problem with you. He didn't like your face or whatever. And, you know, and he just wanted to file an eviction. Let's say you go beat it in court and the judge says, oh, this is, you know, this has no basis. You would think that that should go off your record, and a judge will oftentimes seal that record and seal it from public view. But these companies that provide these algorithms, because they're just gobbling up data en masse as it comes out over time constantly, they will still have in their database that you faced an eviction filing. Even if it's sealed from public view and theoretically should not be allowed to be seen by anybody, these companies
will. The fact that it was filed, yes, is what brings it up.
Right.
And so I was reading your article, and the client that you were talking to, it said that she basically had an eviction, but she didn't have an eviction, and therefore she could not rent a property.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and that's happened several times in your story that you know of.
Right. The lawsuit in this case is against a big landlord and institutional landlord in Northeast Florida, JWB, stands for Jacksonville Wealth Builders. And the lawsuit, the specific argument made in the lawsuit is actually kind of interesting. It's separate from the algorithm, which is why they're not suing the actual algorithm company here. They're suing JWB because they're saying JWB's use of these algorithms, both when the algorithm is wrong and mismatches someone, or when it's right, but it finds a filing that was ended up being moot and wasn't an actual eviction. They use that as a, you know, allegedly, this is what they allege, is that JWB says that's an automatic disqualifier regardless of the legitimacy of the filing, whether it applied to you. And so that's the sort of extra layer here, because there is a lawsuit in Chicago now that is making this same argument against one institutional landlord out in Illinois. Basically the same, but these are the first two lawsuits, as far as I can tell, that have ever made this argument, that it, which is basically that it discriminates against Black renters in specific, because Black renters, just there's extensive data showing they shoulder a disproportionate amount of eviction filings in America, and you know, the data shows in Duval County, Florida specifically.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, if you want to trace racism in America, the first place you look at is housing. Because across the board, housing has been a place where it shows up. I can tell you, before the big technology came into effect, being a young man growing up in Jacksonville and just trying to get an apartment, you know, you don't know specifically if it's because you're Black, but when you apply, and there's, it's interesting to me that, like, I live in Riverside and I drive by plenty of apartments that I applied for. My credit was good enough to get that apartment. I had enough money and I got denied. And after being denied so long, you begin to think that, like, there's got to be something that I'm not catching here. And it's pretty, you know, to me at the time, it felt pretty clear that it was because I was Black. So, like, this type of discrimination has not changed, it hasn't gone away. It's just changed in the way it shows up. Because when you are programming algorithms, the same people who have the biases in real life end up programming those biases into the algorithm.
Yes, and it almost creates like an extra layer of unaccountability, if you will, right? To say, well, it's the algorithm.
It's the algorithm, but right. It's like you're not taking into effect the way race affects us in every way, shape, form, or fashion in this country.
No, yeah, I mean, it's like you say, it's almost, you could argue it's just a different flavor of the same thing that's gone on for generations. Yeah.
And you can join the conversation at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC on air. First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. And you can find us on Facebook and Instagram. And we're going to go to the phones now. We've got Charlie on line one. Charlie, how are you today?
I'm good, Al. You kind of just touched on what I'm curious about. It would seem to me the issues that you were dealing with should not be allowed. When someone goes, and I have a friend who, it took him forever to get an apartment, and he had tons of money, and for whatever reason, because of his age or because he was a little unique in certain ways, he couldn't get anything. So when you have this, you have race, you have gender, mixed genders, age, these issues, it seems to me it should be against the law for someone like you were discriminated against, or someone who's of a mixture gender base or older age and got lots of money. Why should they be able to discriminate against those people? That should be against the law.
Charlie, thanks so much for your call. And I will tell you that it is against the law. You are 100% right. It is against the law. The issue, though, is proof. You know, the law has a very high level of proof that you have to be able to prove that someone is specifically discriminating against you based on race. I can tell you, like, some experiences that I've had when I filled out an application in Riverside. And back in the day, like when in my 20s, and that was a long time ago, in my 20s, when I was filling out applications in Riverside, I would fill out an application and you were just giving it to either the homeowner, or I remember there was a realty company that owned a lot of the real estate, or that managed a lot of the real estate in Riverside. And so you would have to go in and hand that application over to them. And they see who you are. They know exactly who you are. And so, and also they know, like, what clients of theirs are okay with renting to people of color and who aren't. So, but proving that is a very hard thing to do.
Yeah, no, and just to be fair in discussing the lawsuit, that's kind of the lawsuit's in settlement talks now, and so we don't know where it's going. It could go to a jury trial, though, if they don't settle. But JWB's defense is essentially, we deny everything you're saying and prove it.
Prove
that we are actually harming Black renters, that we are using this policy to discriminate against Black renters in specific. And, you know, it does. Yeah, it seems like a very high burden of proof, I would think.
And I think the issue with that, like, if you are fighting against an algorithm, that in order to prove it, you have to have a lot of data, and getting that data to prove it can be extremely complicated. I say this because I worked on a project where we looked at redlining, and how redlining is the practice of not lending in neighborhoods of color. Primarily Black neighborhoods, but also Latino neighborhoods as well. And so it was a practice that happened you know, for a very long time until laws were passed in the 60s that were supposed to stop it, but it didn't stop it. And in order for us to prove it at my other show, Reveal, the amount of records that we had to go through, it took like almost 2 years to go through millions and millions and millions of data points in order to be able to prove what we were saying. So I imagine when we're talking about, just from my experience doing that, I imagine that when we're talking about the case against this algorithm, that being able, it's really hard to prove these things.
Yeah, and it's a private company that
Doesn't have to share its data.
Right. Yeah. You know, I don't know that there's any other way except for a jury trial and discovery to
bring it forth. And we're going to go to the phones. We've got Tim in Orange Park. Tim, my friend, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great, Al. How about yourself?
Good.
Good. You know, that was funny bit that you just mentioned the redlining, because I followed the Reveal program that you had on redlining, but that's not what I'm calling about. I have a house that I'm fixing up. I have two, mm-hmm. and I want to do like a rent to own on it. And I'm just wondering, is there a, because I don't want to use any algorithms or anything, and I'd like to be as fair as I possibly can. And so is there like an organization or a program that I can go through in order to, you know, not just get the best price for my house, but make sure that somebody gets in there that's deserving or that needs a break? And that's about it.
Tim, thanks so much for calling. Charlie, do you know of any programs like that?
Oh man, not off the top of my head. I mean, I think maybe one idea would be, you know, you can use the algorithm, but it all comes down to how you use the algorithm, right? Like the you go to a company that provides you these tenant screening algorithms, you know, they simply provide you information. You can kind of decide what to do with it. And so like the argument in this lawsuit is that, you know, JWB should be more open if someone comes to them and says, hey, you wrongly matched me with somebody else who had an eviction filing. I have like a pristine record as a renter and I'm, you know, this is not me. You could be open and say, well, let's reopen your application and see. OK, yeah. And so I guess it just comes down to, you know, your personal decisions as a landlord, maybe. But who knows? I'm not the one to give advice.
Yeah. I have no idea where you would go for that. And I would just say that, like, as a landlord, I can tell you that, like, it is it's scary renting out, especially when you're a small landlord, right? And if your tenant doesn't pay the rent, that can affect you paying the mortgage. So it's scary on both sides. Like, both sides have a lot to lose. We're going to go to the phones again. We've got Richard on the north side. Hey, Richard, how you doing this morning?
Hey, doing great. Al, listen, you're about to get the title as the hardest working man in radio. So I appreciate you. Listen, my thought was I grew up in the 60s. So it was in the days when the apartment complexes wasn't called the hoods. In fact, I remember a sign on our apartment. One of the first things I learned to read, and it said, this is your home. Take good care of it. Make it an example for all who pass by. And ironically, I remember that. And I always think how the hood used to be when we were growing up. And then you talk about a red line. You can draw a line around the Fair Housing Act. When that was passed, all of these states began to do backlash stuff. And we got rid of government projects that used to be built. And we started using private money. My specific question, there are some requirements that when these apartment complexes that spring up out of nowhere get government funding, they're supposed to have a certain set aside for HUD vouchers. But by law, they don't have to put a HUD flag out there. They don't advertise it. And so it's like that's probably the best way to tell where there's discrimination at the very least, because the federal government pays for those vouchers. And we can get that information from the government as far as who's getting into these apartment complexes using these vouchers. We can start there and then work our way back. I'm wondering if your guest has any information on that.
Richard, thank you so much. That's a great question.
Yeah, no, he's describing, I think Richard's describing something that maybe constitutes its own story or multiple ones. And I've thought about we're sort of working on looking at, I think this algorithm issue has multiple fronts. But public housing is one that's very interesting. I mean, you know, what are the screening practices? You know, at someone like somewhere like Jacksonville Housing Authority, is it similar? Are there differences?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think so. Like the public records, the ability to request public records from the government, this is one of those things that I think it makes that law so valuable.
Yeah. And I think to Richard's point, some of the reporting that I've done in the past about big developers coming in and promising that they are going to allocate space for HUD and for other low-cost programs or low-income programs. In the reporting that I have done, several of those developments actually didn't follow through. I'm thinking about specifically like a story I did in New York. They didn't follow through on doing that. And the only thing they had to face with not following through and like actually having those homes for, you know, people of different economic means was that they had to pay a fine. And they paid the fine, and then they just kept going on and making money. So, like, the idea of, like, someone not agreeing to what they said when they began the proposal and the cost that it cost them afterwards to ignore that, like, it just feels like there needs to be an eye on that, and there needs to be some sort of enforcement that has teeth. Because I think that the big issue when you're talking about dealing with these big developments and developers, I don't think the developers are the bad guy. I'm just saying that, like, when you look at development and politicians and city officials, we need development. We need to, like, you know, keep growing and building the city, but we need to do it in ways that are smart and also that include everybody. But I think there can be an imbalance between the two.
Yeah, and there's a big debate that, you know, it goes on everywhere, but has heated up here in Jacksonville just in the last couple months of, you know, this difference between affordable housing and workforce housing, I believe, which is basically you could build something that's called affordable housing, but is it actually affordable to the people who need that housing the most? I mean, I think I remember the number was Jacksonville Housing Authority said its wait list for public housing in Section 8 had skyrocketed to something like 147,000 people just on those various wait lists.
And a few. Oh, I'm sorry, man. A few comments from Twitter. There's a ton of research on algorithmic discrimination about what makes this example of AI bias is so interesting. Is that the landlord has chosen to override the algorithm, resulting in people of color being denied lease agreements. I don't think your story is necessarily about landlords overriding the algorithms. It's more like landlords just going with whatever the algorithm says.
Right. Not overriding, but just, yes, exactly. Sort of sticking to a flag, and even when it's proven that the algorithm was wrong, still going with what that incorrect conclusion was.
And Vicky emailed, since Melissa Ross left, it seems like every conversation is now about race and discrimination. I hate this station has become one-sided. Interesting comment, Vicky. Interesting comment. I would just say that when we, one is that the host of this show is a black man. And two, that I can only host this show through the lens in which I have lived my life. And I think that there are people who would like me to not talk about race because it makes them feel uncomfortable. And I would say that being uncomfortable is the only place that you grow. And my job here is to challenge listeners, to challenge myself, and to challenge my guests. And that's what I'm going to continue to do. I thank you, Vicky, for listening to the show, and I'm sorry you're not comfortable with being challenged. But unfortunately, I'm going to keep doing that. You can join the conversation. You can call us at 549-2937. You can tweet us at FCC on air. You can email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And you can also reach out to us on Facebook and Instagram. We're going to go to the phones. We've got William on the south side. William, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great. I am so glad that y'all are having this conversation. I'm a former teacher, so when I'm talking to the kids about how the algorithms are run, they are created by people, and those people still have biases in them that they place in the algorithms. So I'm so happy that you're having this conversation so people understand that the technology is still run by human beings,
Exactly.
But my question, too, is that the companies that are building all of these rental units, and what is happening to the monies that they're collecting? Are they staying within Jacksonville or Florida, or are they taking them out? Because if they're taking out these rentals, the money that people are paying in rent from Jacksonville, it's not really benefiting Jacksonville, because there's literally thousands of rental units that are, you know, are not being used. And you would think that these companies would try to make sure that they are, that they do have residents, that they do have people living there. And then when you're talking about the housing crisis, would that also contribute to there being a housing crisis? Because you're looking at so many units being, even the South Side where we are, you know, Bay Meadows, near I-295, there's so many popping up that weren't here like 2 or 3 years ago. But you're paying these rents, but where are these rents going? Or is it actually contributing to, you know, our tax base or what here in Jacksonville? And I appreciate the comments.
William, thanks so much. I would just say, from what I understand about the housing crisis, is that there are a lot of factors that lean into it. And I think one of the biggest factors is greed, that we have big corporations buying single family homes and ending up taking them off the market, which also does two things. It inflates the price of home buying in not just in Northeast Florida, but throughout the country. Like, so if a big corporation comes in and they buy up these single family homes, and they buy them up to rent them out, or maybe even Airbnb or something like that, what it does is it raises the cost of buying a house for somebody that's not a corporation, that's like a family looking to get in. So that adds to the housing crisis. Then you build all of these new apartments all over the place, but those apartments, the rents that they are charging are higher, which ends up keeping a lot of people out of that market from being able to do it. And again, that creates another part of the housing price crisis. So you're creating more stock, but that stock is going to people with, you know, higher incomes, and it creates a housing crisis for lower incomes. And then you've got this story that Charlie reported on.
Yeah, right. I mean, and just adding to what you're saying, you know, it is on top of all of that, rents skyrocketing. There's just way less housing for people who need it most. Is I think this eviction, this sort of faulty algorithm issue, maybe leading to people wrongfully being denied homes, that really hits hard for people who need housing the most and who don't have anything to fall back on. You know, like, you know, if you don't have a family member who has a place where, in the last ditch, desperate effort, you don't have anywhere else to go, you can sleep on their couch. If you don't have anything like that, then it can really, it's really a material harm, you know, to your ability to survive. If you find a place and you sort of put all of your weight on getting that, and then all of a sudden you're denied for a reason that you didn't even, you couldn't have even predicted. But, you know, yeah, I think your point is correct with just, in terms of the caller mentioned, so, you know, is this money staying in Jacksonville? And it's this point of corporate concentration, kind of, which I think is persists in like every industry almost in America, but certainly in this housing industry. Is, you know, 30, 40 years ago, you probably had a lot more, you know, mom and pop landlords, you know, where it was a much more diverse housing market, if you will, of landlords you can go to. And as that group becomes smaller, and as, you know, thousands of properties fall under one sort of corporate hand, you know, those corporations have to make money or make a profit to, you know, stay functional. And, you know, they want to make a lot of profit. Mm-hmm. And then that becomes their money. Who knows where it's going from there, right? It becomes a private company's money, right?
Yeah. You can join the conversation at 549-2937. Tweet us at FCC On Air, First Coast Connect at WJCT.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Going to the phones, we got Jeff on the west side. Jeff, my friend, how are you this morning?
I'm doing good. How about yourself?
Good, good, good. What's your question?
So, comment, actually. You made a comment about your lived experience when you were in the early 20s.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a landlord. And I'm here to tell you that if a single adult male in his 20s came through, whatever his age, I would probably not do it. Actuarials with insurance companies will charge you extra money because you're 20 in your mid 20s, single, and you have to pay more for car insurance. But we can't do that as a landlord for properties. So I am probably not going to have that experience as a landlord, having a mid 20s single male. Just not going to happen.
Jeff,
so
Jeff, the one
I understand and appreciate your
sure,
I understand and appreciate your concern that it was due to race, and I don't doubt that that played a factor, particularly in Riverside. I'm sure it's 20 years ago now, but there's other factors as well, and when you highlight them as only being due to race, when in your commentary on it, that presents a picture, which is why the young lady on the tweet made that comment.
Okay. Well, Jeff, hold on. Let me clarify a few things. Number one, it was 30 years ago. I'm old. Number two, I was not single. I said I was a young man in my 20s, but, I've had kids since I was 23. So I was not single. I was married and kids. And three, I didn't say that was the reason. I said, you don't know. I said that, like, as a black man going out, applying, and I've got the money, my credit was good. I wasn't single. I had a family, had a partner, who also had a job. And you're constantly getting denied. You don't know, but you think that maybe race is a part of it. That is specifically what I said. So I hear your points, and I'm a landlord too. And I can tell you that there are plenty of intangibles that go into the making a decision about whether or not you're going to rent to somebody. But all the reporting that I have done, and you can check my resume, it's pretty long, all the reporting that I have done has pointed to the fact that race shows up in pretty much every aspect of American life. Every aspect. You can look at, like, my reporting in policing. I've proven that. You can look at my reporting in housing. I've proven it there. And actually, you know, just to be really clear with you, like, the two stories that I'm talking about won Peabody's. Like, I'm not just the person who's getting on here saying, like, this, that, and the other thing without any proof behind the things that I am saying to you. What I am saying to you is that news organizations across the country deemed the information that I am giving to you worthy and correct and factual. So it's not just me saying, like, oh, I have this feeling and my feelings are hurt. It's me saying that I have the data to prove it.
Okay, that's fine. I will back off on my comments about the single adult male, but that was the race was the only thing that you brought up.
No, my friend, that's not. I said, like, I don't know. I don't know, but it's a factor when you are a young black man in America and you're getting mysterious no's all the time and no one is being straight with you. Like, it's a factor. You wonder about whether it is or whether it isn't. And what I'm also saying to you is that the reporting that I have done in over the 30 years that I've been alive, the reporting that I've done has proven that it's not just a feeling, but there is data behind what I'm saying to you. There's proof behind what I'm saying to you. And also, like, please understand, like, just because I'm being clear and trying to communicate this to you, I'm not taking this as an adversarial conversation. I'm taking it as, like, two people who are trying to get an understanding of where the other person comes from. So I don't think that, like, you're wrong or evil or racist or anything like that. I'm saying that, like, you have one lived experience. I have another lived experience. But I can tell you from my reporting, from the facts that I have gathered in the field, that absolutely there is a difference between you and my lives. And a lot of the difference in between those two happened to be race, because this is America, a country that was founded on stolen land and built by forced slave labor. So you can't escape those things. A lot of people would like to. Hell, I would like to. I would like to live in a world where it's all fair and good. But that's not the world we live in. We have to live in reality, and we have to find ways to work together to make that reality come together so that America can be exactly what it has always been intended to be, or at least what the words intended it to be. Jeff, you with me?
I mean, I'm with you, but I just, you know, I'm not, A, I didn't say all of those things.
I didn't say you did. I'm saying I'm literally following up the conversation.
We have met before. I was a teacher at Duval Academy over at the prison side. You came and did some workshops there. I actually know and appreciate you, and I don't know if you remember me or not. I was a science teacher there.
Yeah, I got fired from there, so I don't remember. You're not the reason why I got fired, but I got fired from that job, so I don't remember much about it. No, like I said, Jeff, like we're not like having a confrontational conversation. We're having a conversation, from at least from my side, where like I'm trying to explain to you my lived experience, and I'm listening to your lived experience. I wouldn't take anything away from you as a landlord. I think that what you're saying about like the there are other factors in it, I think that is totally valid, and I hear you on it. And I'm not assigning any kind of blame to you that you've discriminated against anybody. I'm hearing what you're saying. I think it's valid. I think it's totally valid. I was just correcting the record that like I wasn't saying that like I was a single Black man looking for a place, and also correcting the record that like, you know, I'm sorry, but race is a part of everything we do here in America. And the issue is that white people don't have to see that because they don't have to live it. But I do.
So I just am here to tell you that it is comments like that is driving what that one person tweeted in about, that it is,
I'm sure
that's going to lose you. That is that kind of comment that is going to lose the listenership.
I'm sure there's a segment of the listenership that it will lose, and I'm sorry to see them go. Jeff, thanks so much for your time. We have to wrap up this segment. Please call back anytime. I would love to talk to you more. And that is all for this segment, but we will be right back. Charlie McGee, thank you so much for coming in. I am sorry we didn't get to talk more about, we just got sidetracked down all sorts of holes.
It was entertaining in its own right.
All right. Charlie McGee, ladies and gentlemen of the Tributary, check them out online. They are an amazing news source for Jacksonville.
Following Hurricane Idalia, Citizens Property Insurance reminds customers to stay safe during recovery and to report claims online at citizensfla.com or by phone 24/7 at 866-411-2742.
Stories, interviews, books, puzzles, investigations, Tiny Desk, podcasts, NPR. Donate, thanks.
Please call 353-9528 and thank you.
Hey, 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 welcome back. You are listening to First Coast Connect. I'm Al Letson, sitting in the big chair in Studio 2 at WJCT. So new COVID-19 boosters could be available any day now following FDA and CDC approval earlier this week. Jacksonville-based hospitalist Dr. Jennifer Cowart is online now, and everything we need to know about them, she is going to tell us, and the latest with this new strain. So, Dr. Cowart, how are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for coming on to talk to us. So before we talk about the vaccine, like, let's talk a little bit about this new strain of COVID. How worried should we be about it?
Well, we're definitely seeing a rise in cases in our community here in Jacksonville, as well as many surrounding areas. So, and personal story, I just recovered from it myself.
Oh, no.
Had it last week.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank goodness for Paxlovid. I just have to say, made me feel better very, very quickly. But yeah, we're seeing rising cases right now. And we are seeing some of those coming into the hospital, not a huge, you know, surge like we saw early in the pandemic. So I would say hospitals are okay, you know, not overwhelmed, nothing like that. But definitely a lot of people sick right now. And so we're seeing kids, you know, having to miss school. We're seeing people stuck home, not able to go to work. And then, of course, anybody who's been at risk for bad outcomes from COVID this whole time remains at risk for bad outcomes. So your folks who are immunocompromised, they have cancer, they have immunosuppressive treatments or a transplant. Those folks are still at risk for very serious outcomes from COVID. And so we're definitely seeing it out there. We want to keep everybody safe.
Yeah. I mean, before COVID came along, I would usually get a flu vaccine, mostly because I have asthma, and whenever I get sick, if it gets into my lungs, I'm in trouble. Like, it turns into bronchitis and all sorts of stuff. And so I'm wondering, I bring that up to say, has COVID become like our new flu booster? Like, basically, you know, that time of the year, you go back and you get your booster.
I think it's really approaching that status. Yeah. This year they're updating the COVID shot for this year, and they're telling us to expect that probably once a year we'll get an updated COVID shot to match the circulating variants at the time. And it'll be my guess, it'll be an annual booster shot, kind of like the flu shot. And so I, like you, I also have asthma, and every cold and flu I ever get goes straight into my chest.
Oh,
it's pretty miserable.
Worst. Yes.
It's the worst. And so for me and my family, the right thing to do is to take those vaccines. So I take a flu shot every year, and I will be very happy to take a COVID shot every year to match those circulating variants, because I want to reduce my risk of getting really sick with asthma and bronchitis. And I also want to reduce my risk of getting sick at all so that I don't get long COVID. You know, long COVID is still a thing. Many people are affected, and not getting sick with COVID is the first best way to not get long COVID.
There's a lot of misinformation about the vaccines. I saw this recently on Instagram where someone was talking about, oh, these vaccines just came out of nowhere and people just took them, whatever. But during COVID, I actually had the opportunity of interviewing a scientist that had been working on the vaccine. And one of the things that I learned from her was that they had been working on a vaccine to SARS-1 for over a decade. And it was their belief at the time, this is before the vaccines came out, it was their belief at the time that most of the research and the work that they had done on SARS-1 was going to help us tackle SARS-2, which is COVID. And so basically, like, the idea that these vaccines came out of nowhere is not accurate. Like, people have been working on these vaccines for a very long time when it comes to, like, the SARS virus.
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that was, you know, quote unquote, new about the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines was the mRNA technology. That was really the first time it had gone into prime time production. But to your point, that technology had been in development for over a decade, coming out of the original SARS pandemic, and also work on an HIV vaccine, which, side note, we definitely need that. So the technology had been in development for a long time, proving its safety, proving its efficacy. And because that technology is more adaptable, I think that was the reason they were better able to quickly ramp up and get those first set of COVID vaccines so quickly in this new pandemic. And they're using that same technology now, just updating the strains to match in the updated Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. And then there is also a Novavax vaccine, which uses a more traditional, older method of producing the vaccine. It's not an mRNA vaccine. We don't have that one yet updated, but that should be coming soon.
All right. Jacksonville-based hospitalist Dr. Jennifer Coward, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us.
Everybody get your shots.
All right. Thank you so much. And we will be right back.
LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at LifeSouth.org to find a blood drive near you. Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at CongareeAndPen.com. Scenic Jacksonville presents the Great City Symposium, October 4th. A.G. Lafley, former CEO of Procter & Gamble, shares how he led the revitalization of downtown Cincinnati and the Sarasota Bay waterfront. Tickets at scenicjacksonville.com.
Stories, interviews, books, puzzles, investigations, Tiny Desk, podcasts, NPR. Donate, thanks.
Please call 353-9528 and thank you.
On the next Fresh Air, how the military is struggling to modernize its weapon systems. The Army and Navy are testing weapons with remarkable capabilities using cutting-edge digital technology and AI. We'll talk with Eric Lipton of the New York Times about his investigation into the weapons, the need to modernize, and the obstacles in the way. Join us
today at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
Panic attacks. They can make their sufferers feel like they're going to die. Next time on 1A, ABC's chief national correspondent Matt Gutman shares his story. His new book looks at the science and treatment of an anxiety disorder that often goes undiagnosed and how magic mushrooms and meditation have helped him heal.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
My name's Scott Detrow, and I host All Things Considered on the weekends. I really enjoy the challenge of considering all things. You know, you can be on the line with a senator, then you're shifting gears and you're talking to a musician, you know. For the bulk of my career as a member station reporter, I was a statehouse reporter. So many things that affect people's lives are happening in those buildings. In just about every state, there's a public radio reporter there. It is a very challenging time to be a reporter. The business models that made journalism work for decades have gone up in smoke, and people increasingly just tune in to news sources that tell them what they want to hear. Public radio stations have really kind of stepped up in the middle of all of this to tell you the facts, to give you the information you need to make your own decisions. The whole NPR network is stronger with your support. Give to this station today, and thanks.
Please call 353-9528 or visit wjct.org/radio.
Ah, that lovely music that makes you feel good in your heart. That's why we're playing this, because we want you to feel really good in your heart right now. Because, hey, we're your friend. You're our friend. And we're in need. You're listening to WJCT, and it's Pledge Drive time. It's time for us to make it official. So give us a call right now at 1-800-722-9528. That's 1-800-722-9528. And you can give to the station that you love so much. With me in the studio right now is my main man, Mr. David Luckin. David, how are you, sir?
I am so glad to be here. And I want to thank some folks. Al, first of all, I want to thank you for being here because it's a pleasure to be on your show. I want to thank Marion in Jacksonville, Jennifer in Jacksonville, Lindsay in Jacksonville, and get this, Smokey D Barbecue in Jacksonville. They gave us a really generous donation this morning. I won't say how much, but it was over $900. And they have challenged every other barbecue place in town to do the same. Maybe not at that level, but at any level that fits you. Smokey D's is challenging you. Maria in St. Augustine called us. Matthew in St. Augustine called. And Heddle in Jacksonville called. So thank you so much for your financial support. We only come to you a couple times a year. This is that time. So please take the time now. If you appreciate what we just did for the last hour or almost hour on First Coast Connect, then call. If you're waiting for 1A or Fresh Air or all the other great programs we have, you need to call us right now. We're only here for 3 days. So please do your part and do it for your neighbors. This is community radio. Everyone can't afford it, but if you can, you're paying it forward for the whole community.
Right. That's the thing. Like when I think about WJCT and when I think about public media, there was a time in my life where I listened to this station all the time. I mean, I still do, but when I was younger, I would listen to This American Life. That was my jam. And there was this guy who made this great music. I think his name was David Luckin. It was called Electro Lounge.
Oh, back in the day.
You know, I would listen to all of that. And I didn't have money to contribute, but somebody else contributed for me. And that's the thing. It's like giving a gift to the community that you love. In order to have a thriving community that has engaging conversations. Like today's conversation went in places that I had no idea was going to go when I sat down at the microphone. But I love that. I think that like that shows that this community is vital and has important things to talk and debate about.
And engaged.
And engaged. And like, where else are you going to hear that on the airwaves except right 89.9?
And we're proud to do that every morning, and we've always been proud of the callers, whether we agree with them or not. Often the callers call in with some questions we didn't think of. And to your point, Al, we do a meeting every day, and we didn't plan this show quite the way it turned out.
No, not at all. And you said you're happy to be on my show. This is your show, too.
No, but, well, yeah, but I was wanting to work with you, and we never really got a chance.
I know.
We're in the same building. But we work together every day, and it's good fun. And we can't do it without you, the listeners. We've been here for more than 40 years. This yep. program's been on the air 14 plus years now. And it's just about community. We want to talk to you. We want you to talk to us. And we thank Al for being our interim host.
Right.
He's filling in for the blanks here, and he's doing a great job. But we can't do it without your support. So won't you take the time now? Give us a call at 353-9528. Go online. You don't have to talk to anyone at wjct.org/radio. And I will tell you now, we don't share any of your information. Mm-mm. So call us.
No. And, you know, there coming in as the host, the interim host of this program has been amazing. Jacksonville, you've been so warm and welcoming to me. And what that tells me is that this station is very important to you. Like, it's interesting to me how I go places and people just, I was at the Y the other day and someone stopped me and said like, oh my God, the show is so good. That just means the world to me, one, and to the team that helps make this show. Because I mean, I'm the guy on the mic, but there's a whole staff of people who just
making you look good.
Yeah, absolutely. Like my man Brady, who I always mess up his name at the end of the show, and he still
likes you. You're still his friend.
I feel like that's got to be a bit. Like I'm gonna start calling him, you know, Brady something something.
Just BC. Keep it easy.
Exactly. Even though I can say his mom's name so easy, I don't know. It's weird. But all these beautiful, dedicated people come in here to make a great show, even with a problematic host. And they do it because they love Jacksonville and they love the conversation and pushing it forward. And so this is the place where we do that. This is the place where you get to hear your voice and also, you know, hear other people in the community, whether you agree with them or not, like you get to hear them. So please, donate to the station. Call us now at 1-800-722-9528. That's 1-800-722-9528. And that is our show today, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening. We've got a great show coming up for you tomorrow. And please tune in. And remember, y'all, keep your heart open for Duval and each other. And I'll talk to you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.